Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. A little bit later in the program, Andy Smith is going to be here. He is, you know, from Financial Engines. I talk about Financial Engines almost every day, and there are commercials that run with Andy and me. He's in town, and we're going to sit down and talk a little bit about retirement and things. Oh, I know what we're going to talk about. We're talking about pensions and the fact that more and more of them are going away. Even as you're holding the paper, your pension's disappearing. So that's coming up with Andy a little bit. But every other Thursday, Dennis Rodkin comes by. He writes about real estate for Crane Chicago Business, and he is in the studio this afternoon. Dennis, welcome back.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
Good. All right. Let's get on the bullet train or the
bullet.
What was the train they were going to build for a time? The individual passenger. Remember that? They were going to take you out to the northwest suburbs. It was like an individual. Do you remember that at all?
I have a picture of the renderings in
okay,
my head.
Okay, well,
yeah.
Let's get in it and go to Hoffman Estates.
Here we go.
So the Hoffman Estates Village Board is going to consider this proposal, I think, next week.
On Monday, yeah.
It sounds like a wild thing. Tell me about it.
Wild and huge.
Yeah.
Over 1,000 units of housing, 200,000 square feet of commercial shops and offices, trails, wetlands. It's on 186 acres. All those kinds of amenities, as well as an outdoor ice skating rink and a tranquility center.
It sounds like the Truman Show a little bit to me. But it won't be Truman Show because it's all different sorts of housing, right?
Yeah, and they're not planning to build a bubble over
no,
the
no
town,
bubble?
Just so
okay.
you know. Yeah.
Well, not
yeah,
phase
but it's,
one.
One of the interesting things is this mix of housing. There are a lot of types of housing that the developer, the master developer, describes as the missing middle for the suburbs, the kinds of things that are very traditional in the city, older suburbs, like, for example, a three flat. You know,
right,
traditionally,
right.
especially in the city, I buy a three flat, I rent out the other two units either to family or to tenants, and that helps cover my mortgage. That's not something that's all that common out in that direction. They're going to have some of those. There will be rental townhouses, and there will also, and several other types of housing, including what you might think of as sort of courtyard homes. We all have rear garages, and our front doors face into a common green space, which is also actually a very old style of housing, but not something we do a lot in the city. That's why it's called new urbanism. It's come back in the last few decades. So I'd have these walking trails that would thread through my neighborhood and other neighborhoods.
And that's how you would get to the shops?
Get to the shopping, yeah, and wander around the edge of the whole center of it. I think about 70 of the 186 acres would be a wetland complex, and the trails would pass along that.
So it and 8 years to build, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, that's one of those things. Builders might say a year, and then we have a recession, and it takes 8 years. Or they say 8 years, and we have a super fast market, and it takes one. But yeah, their projection is about 8 years.
And he needs to get approval? Because Philip Hoffman Estates needs to annex some land to make it all work.
Yeah. About 140, I think, of the 186 acres is up for an annexation to Hoffman Estates. That's to be discussed Monday. There are other approvals that would all have to go through, but they would then build in phases. It's not as if a year from now right. there are 1,000 homes built. He would be the master, or his firm would be the master developer, and somebody comes along to build some apartments, and somebody else wants to build a neighborhood, a single family, but within these guidelines
sure.
that they've laid down. So it could take quite a while.
Okay, I want to move on, but tell me the story of the land, because it's interesting.
It's kind of amazing.
Yeah.
His dad bought it in 1959.
Because he knew.
He saw the northwest suburbs coming that way. He was in Melrose Park. He was a World War II veteran. He bought northwest of Chicago and northwest of Tucson, and the family still has most of its northwest of Chicago land, but sold off the Tucson land as suburbs moved out that direction.
So, and now they're here. So this
yeah.
is sort of fruition of his dad's dream.
Yeah, almost 60 years later.
What a cool story.
Yeah.
Okay, tell me about, you know, I've complained about this before. BHHS
yeah.
Koenig Rubloff. Right away, name's too big, you know.
And that's the short version. It's 17 syllables long.
And so they are among the realtor groups in Chicago.
Right.
But they're the only ones not doing better?
The only one. Yeah, for 3 years in a row, when the others in the top five have grown their sales volume, Berkshire Hathaway, Koenig.
Let's do Berkshire.
Berkshire. Their sales have shrunk. Last year, 2016, which is what this data is for, they were down 2%. The others in the top five were up 3 to 10% in sales volume. And, you know, real estate sales is sort of an odd thing because I don't necessarily go to the name of the brand, I go to the agent I like.
Right.
And the brand is sort of a confederation of the agents. But when you look at this, they're down 16% in 3 years, while everybody else has been rising, and again, down 2% just in the past year. The others in the top five all growing.
So any idea of why?
Well, there are several things that people have said. It's part of it is that you go to an agent, and several agents have left Berkshire. But I think it may also be there's a little bit of a struggle here. Just before that 3 years ago mark, there were two firms in Chicago that merged under this national banner, Berkshire Hathaway. And I think there may still be a little bit of time needed to figure out what we are. Are we this national brand? Are we these local brands? And
right, okay, and you said, though, people tend to pick their realtor.
Right.
I mean, you throw a rock, right? And there are a few realtors. So
yeah, we're all related to seven.
That's the point I'm making. Yeah. You all know, everyone knows a realtor or is friends of a friend of a realtor. So how much does the parent company impact? I mean, is this going to end up feeding off itself and costing them?
Well, this was something I wrote when they merged. I wrote about that. This question of, you know, Berkshire Hathaway is Warren Buffett's company, and he wasn't big in residential real estate at the time. He had residential real estate operations, but they were sort of creating a more national brand, and this was a piece of it. And the question was, you know, do you think the Warren Buffett brand is what you want to go with, or do you want to go with something local? We have two examples. Coldwell Banker is our biggest brokerage in the area. They're very much a national brand. And our second business is At Properties, which is very much a local and locally owned brand. So you can't say, oh, well, they're failing because it's only local brands that do well. And you can't say the opposite either.
All right. Answer me this question. Because I don't know. I know that I don't know the answer. I think of, well, do these brokerages advertise as a company? I mean, I think of Century 21 when they did with the gold jackets. And as I posed it in my head, I think, well, maybe Coldwell Banker does, right? Do they advertise as a firm, as a company?
Does Berkshire Hathaway or does Coldwell
Banker? Any of them.
Well, I think they do a lot of branding. Like Berkshire Hathaway has this very clear, very visible burgundy color. Coldwell Banker is blue. At Properties has sort of a yellow, I guess it would be yellow and red branding. So you see a lot of that, but and they'll wrap that around Joe Blow, a Berkshire Hathaway agent. And so I think the idea is that it transfers. I like Joe Blow, but he doesn't sell in my neighborhood. Here's somebody else with that same color.
Right.
Or I don't know Joe Blow, but I know this color.
Well, that's Dennis Rodkin. I'm just not going to go anywhere from there. We're going to take a break, and we'll come back. And a couple of old houses. We're going to go vintage after this with a couple of great stories you've written in the past week or so. It's 12:22. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Dennis Rodkin in the studio. He writes for Crane Chicago Business about real estate. We were just talking off the air about this being the 25th anniversary of the flood. And, you know, if you were around then, it's, you know, you and I have great stories to tell about it. But
having covered it,
it's one of those things where there weren't lots of pictures. It's not like the fire or anything like that, you know, that has this great sort of resonance unless you were really directly involved in it. But 25 years ago today.
It was crazy. You know, to think that 250 million gallon flood was invisible to almost anybody except the maintenance people underneath Macy's, Marshall Fields at the time, who said, we got fish in the
basement. I was gonna say,
I guess that was Carson's. We've got fish in the basement.
And they didn't eat those fish, though. No,
that was all right.
Okay, well, we're talking of water. Tell me the story of this house built for a survivor of the Titanic. It's up in Lincoln Park, right up on Lakeview.
That was a very good segue. Yeah, so on at 2700 Lakeview, there is a building. A lot of people would recognize it as it's overlooking the park. It's right near the top of the park there. It was Thresholds for a long time. It's got a bunch of fire escapes hanging off it. But when you look past all that, it was a beautiful mansion designed 100 years ago this year by David Adler and Henry Dangler for Emily Ryerson, who, with her kids, escaped the Titanic in a rowboat, I mean, in a lifeboat, but their father, her husband, did not get in the lifeboat.
Right.
He went down with the ship. So that was sort of a celebrated story. And in fact, he shows up very, very briefly in the recent Titanic movie. So she comes back here. She builds this mansion. It's pretty remarkable. goes through a couple of other owners after she moves to New York. And then it has not been residential since 1946. It was a school, then it was Thresholds for about 40 years. Sold 2 years ago. I reported on it then. It was sold to one residential developer who, I don't know why, has now sold it to another residential developer who wants to redo it either as a single family home, a 16,000 square foot single family home for at least $9.5 million, or three condos at $3.5 million and up.
Here's what strikes me about that story. When I buy a house, if I'm going to buy a mansion, which I'm not,
because you already have yours.
Because I already have mine. I'm drawn to this vintage, old, historical building.
Right.
But you're right that the old ones are the ones that are sitting around. They're not selling.
There are a couple. Yeah, there's the Wrigley Mansion just a few blocks from that one. There's a mansion owned by the College of Surgeons on Lakeshore Drive. They've had a hard time selling. But let's be clear, the stuff at up over $8-9 million, that has been selling slowly, except for the super hot new condos.
Right.
Brand new
condos.
So
even the new...
Yeah, it's been harder to get that stuff moved. Yeah, but this one, the interesting thing about this one is because it was a school and then it was Thresholds, most of the interior is just wiped out, except there are some great details. I walked around in there Monday morning. There is this ballroom living room that looks over the park that has these gorgeous herringbone floors from probably 1917, beautiful carved doorways with busts in them.
And what's on the ceiling?
And skid marks from a basketball, because apparently at some point they were using it as a basketball room.
It's just amazing. Yeah. A house like that that was used like that as well. Well, we'll see how they do. And here's another story that I didn't know about until you told me, that some of these houses from the 1933 World's Fair were put on barges, taken to the Indiana Dunes.
Yeah.
A number of them, and there's one that has sort of fallen into disrepair big time.
It's fallen, yeah, big time. It's it was designed by George Fred Keck, not yet a major Chicago architect at that time, but he became a pioneering modernist. He's one of the people, at least for our region, he pioneered the idea of passive solar, positioning your house so that the sun can heat up the house in very intentional ways. And he did a lot of other things, but he designed this house of tomorrow, this glass house. It's before Mises' glass house here in our suburbs. It's before Philip Johnson's glass house in Connecticut. And he was showcasing what we're going to have in our houses in the future, including an airplane hangar and dishwashers and other things. And it was this great model that people walked through at the World's Fair. It and several other houses were bought by a developer after the World's Fair, taken across to Beverly Shores by barge. Beverly Shores at the time was developing as sort of a resort area. Now, as you know, it's a national, some of it is a national park, national seashore. That includes the land these houses are on.
And so these houses are owned by the government?
By the national park.
Okay.
They're leased to Indiana Landmarks. Indiana Landmarks, in turn, has, in all the other houses except the House of Tomorrow, long-term tenants who don't pay to lease the house but have paid for all the renovations. And that, I understand, I didn't get specific figures, but in some cases that's over $1 million they've spent to rehab these relatively modest homes.
And then they go away for 2 weeks in October when the homes are open to the public because they become museums.
Exactly.
It's such a wild thing. And so the House of Tomorrow, this big glass house.
It looks just like a big old mess on its sort of sand dune site. It's wrapped in construction wrap. It just looks horrible, but it could be this glittering sort of model of what we were going to become. So just a week or so ago, we had a story saying that a group of Chicago architects and consultants have been impaneled by Indiana Landmarks, which owns the house, to design a renovation. They expect to spend about $2.5 million on the renovation.
Wow.
They want to make it a more public house than the others are. They can't make it a full-time museum, not enough foot traffic, and it needs to support itself financially. But what are we going to put in it that makes it today's House of Tomorrow is what those architects are discussing.
We'll follow that. Let's get a little Kickstarter campaign going. We'll see what happens.
There we go.
Dennis Rodkin, have a great weekend. Nice to see
Thanks,
you.
Thanks, Steve. See you
it's
again.
The Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Matt Strauss is in the studio. He's the Executive VP, General Manager of Video Services for Comcast Cable. Well, welcome to the studio, Matt. Thanks for
coming
in.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So first of all, you know, when you tell people you work for the cable company, is that a hurdle you have to overcome?
Well, you know, it's...
It's one of those things that it doesn't even matter. Reality doesn't matter as much.
No. Well, look, I think that you know, we are going through a transformation, and certainly, you know, the cable company or cable has always had a certain legacy that I think has been associated with it. But the way I describe it is, you know, we're no longer like, this is not your father's cable company anymore. We've gone through a real transformation.
It is amazing to me. And as I was telling you off the air, I'm 54, so I'm a little behind the curve, but I'm catching up. But it is amazing to me how we now consume our TV. I saw a stat that the average American watches 130 hours of video a month. Is that possible?
That is absolutely. That's a Nielsen stat.
Okay.
And it actually ranges. It's about 130 to 150 hours a month, or about 4 to 5 hours a day.
Does that count live TV?
And it counts all video.
Okay,
so it's
okay.
Live, on demand, if you have a DVR.
Right. And so how is it that you see your customers are watching? How do we watch TV? I'm a Comcast customer.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, the way that I sometimes describe it is, if you love TV, there's no better time to be alive than now.
It's crazy.
There is so much high quality original television. And typically, you know, you'll hear people say there's like so many shows. I don't know which one to watch first.
Right, right.
And I think that what's happened is there's like this unique intersection where you've got really high quality television, but the technology exists, like with Xfinity and with X1, where you can now control what you watch, when you watch it. And I think as a result, people are not only watching more, but they're watching in some ways like smarter, because it's on my terms or it's on your terms.
Right, right, right.
And it's allowing people, I think, just to enjoy entertainment, video entertainment in different ways.
It seems to me that you might have two populations, that you've got one population that is on the cutting edge, taking advantage of everything the moment it comes out, and then the other population that you're probably trying to jump up in front of them and say, look, here's what you can do. Try these new things, right, that are still watching Channel 5 at 8 o'clock on Wednesday to see Chicago Hope or something.
You know what? I think it is absolutely one of our challenges, is just letting, you know, people realize like the innovation, the what's available to them. I think for some, you know, when you watch television, you just may assume the way you watch is the same as your neighbors or,
right,
or your other family, until you see something like X1. And then, you know, typically we'll go like, well, how come I don't have that? Because, you know, when you watch TV, and everyone, of course, watches it differently, but, you know, sometimes it's almost like, you know, you want to sleep or you just want to watch TV. It's like you don't want to think about it.
Right.
And that's, you know, if you have a platform, if you have X1, you know, really what we've been able to do is just provide you all the choices in one place. There's over 100,000 choices that are on demand. It's all the shows are available. So you have like live, you have on demand, you have your DVR. But the way we present it is it's all very visual.
I think you're exactly right. People get into comfort with what they have, and then they don't look for what they might have, right?
Yeah, they don't.
Because I
hear,
I see X1 commercials on TV, and I'm like, I got what I need, you know? And so I don't really pursue it. My mother-in-law just moved into a condo not far from us, and she's got a remote that she's talking into. And I'm like, well, why don't I have that?
Yeah. So this is one where you're going to have X1 envy by the time we're done talking here, because it's really a game changer. And, you know, I'll give you a couple of examples. You know, if you have X1, you can use your voice. So you could talk into the remote. Since we've launched this, it hasn't been that long. We've already have deployed 13 million voice remotes. Like in a given month, over 200 million voice commands are. So you can now talk into your remote. You don't even need to know the channel number, what time it's on. You can just say, watch Game of Thrones. Or you can say, you know, watch The Walking Dead.
Right.
Or you can say, watch Netflix. And you don't have to change inputs. You don't have to like fumble with the remote. You know, so this notion of now just the simplicity of it and having all the choices in one place. Like in a given year, like last year, we had about 4 billion hours of content consumed just on demand. So more and more is happening time shifted, and we're just helping facilitate that with platforms like X1.
So two things. So we started by saying, you know, it's sometimes, you know, where you work, when I go and say where I work, people start talking, right? So can you go to a cocktail party and people not ask you about their personal cable problems? Because I'm about to ask you about one of mine.
you know what? It's not an uncommon occurrence for me where somebody will ask me for it. But truth be told, you know, we certainly are putting a lot of effort into improving it. And more times than not, You know, I've actually had people come up to me, and when they find out what they can do, whether it's with X1 or that they can now download our app, the Xfinity Stream app, and it's like your entire TV is now on your phone. I do think that we are changing the conversation.
Yeah,
more
well,
and more.
That's, and don't get me wrong. I didn't mean complaining. I meant saying, you know, how do I do this or why can't I do this? And in my house, my wife will tell you that I get most angry when I try to watch Netflix on TV and for some reason the bandwidth doesn't work. No. And it locks up. And so if I go through X1, does that take care of that or is that still an issue?
Well,
I've got the Ethernet cable. I got everything going.
Yeah. Well, I think that it may help. I mean, there's so many components to what could impact like your wireless network.
Can you come
over?
Would you be over?
Yeah, I can come over after this. I will make a personal service call.
No, I'd hope that if you went through X1, it would fix that, but that won't.
Well, you know, Netflix actually, they used to do this. I think they still do. They put out like a ratings where they rate all the different high-speed data providers. And we obviously have launched Netflix on X1, and we've been number one.
Okay.
So I do think that it's – I think that the experience has been fantastic.
My wife and I flew – my daughter was studying in Hawaii. We flew to Hawaii a couple of weeks ago. Yeah, it was very nice. And I was really looking forward to watching the little drop-down screen. And instead, United said, oh, you get to watch your shows on your phone. And again, there's a population who might not be used to watching TV shows on – you do it, and you're like – that's pretty nice. I've got the Xfinity app on my phone, and more people I would imagine are watching TV shows, not staring at their TV, but watching their laptop or their phone in their living room.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. If you go back like 20 years, the way you would watch TV is it was tethered to the living room.
Right.
And that just never made sense to us. You know, we always believe that, you know, if you're a Comcast video subscriber, you should have the ability to watch what you want, when you want, and where you want. So, you know, we spent a lot of time with our Xfinity Stream app. It doesn't cost anything if you're a Comcast customer. And it literally does what you just said. It transforms a phone or a tablet or a computer into a TV. And it's not like some of the channels. It's all the channels that you can watch when you're in the home or all the on-demand choices or your DVR where you can actually access it. You know, on my plane ride over here from Philadelphia – I downloaded my DVR recordings and I was watching them on the plane.
Yeah,
so it's
really,
I think that you're just, you're seeing a pace of innovation that, you know, that I think is just accelerating faster than ever before.
Matt Strauss, Executive Vice President, General Manager, Video Services at Comcast. I'm tempted, we're late. Get 20 seconds. What's next?
Well, what's next is you'll continue to see us add more and more things onto X1. YouTube is actually something we announced is coming very soon. And also in Chicago, we're going to be launching soon a new set-top box. It's almost like the size of a hockey puck. It's wireless. It's got Bluetooth. It's HDR if you are looking for like a high dynamic range. And I think that you're just going to continue to see the hardware actually innovate at the same pace as some of our other products.
I want to watch my TV with my headphones on.
There you go. You will have it.
Thanks for coming by. Great
pleasure
to talk to you. It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thanks very much, Steve Alexander. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Andy Smith is in the studio from Financial Engines. Well, we run commercials together. You hear me talk to Andy and talk about Andy. I'm going to say the nice thing since he's here. Welcome back, bud. How are you?
I'm doing great, man.
Hey, okay. So I know we talk from different topics from time to time, but and the one for us today is there was just a change in the pension rules, wasn't there, something like that, where you can go to court if a union or a pension fund is in trouble and they can get the pension payouts reduced. And that just happened in New York with a group of unions, I think.
New York Teamsters 707, the first pension fund to officially basically go under.
And I remember talking about it at the time. There's some restrictions, but now they're paying the people who paid in about half of what they were expecting.
Yeah, so you can imagine you think that your retirement's going to smell like lavender.
Right.
And you're going to get like $1,300 a month, $3,000 a month in some situations. Then all of a sudden ends up smelling like a landfill and you get half of that. And people are having to punt. They have to completely rethink their retirement. Because these pension funds just cannot pay the number of pensioners.
You know, I'm in line for a pension, like a partial pension, and not enough to retire on. I just don't expect it to be there. I'm waiting for it to go away. Is that common? I mean, You know, people talk about Social Security not being there. Are more and more pensions failing?
They are. They're having problems. There's one that we deal with clients right now. It's called the Central States Pension, and they sent letters to however many, thousands of clients. We have a client, Jody, who got one, and it basically said, look, we were paying you $1,400 a month. Now we can only pay you $400 a month. She comes in crying,
right,
doesn't know what to do. She has to completely rethink her retirement because all of a sudden, hey, you thought that you were going to have this wonderful retirement, and it just absolutely blows up on you.
Okay, so what do you do? Because if you're finding this out, the time has passed. I mean, the time, I would assume, to add up a 401k or things like that, right, it might be a little late for you.
So a couple of things. If you are still working, you have this. You potentially have a shot to do a lump sum rollover. So a lot of pensions just want to offload the obligations onto pensioners.
That happened to my dad.
Yeah,
right?
so you can take that as an IRA.
Company comes to you and says, we can pay you this over a period of time, or we'll give you a lump sum.
Right.
And then you have to figure out which one works for you.
So number one, explore that option. Run the numbers. Have an advisor run those numbers. Get some help here. The other thing that you can do is contact your pension plan. Ask for a form 5500, and it talks about something called a funding ratio. You want to see a funding ratio greater than 80%. So I know that there's a lot of teachers
right now,
and they're perking up and writing down Form 5500. Remember that. You want to see a funding ratio greater than 80%. And if you don't, you got to explore some other options.
Why does the date of my grandmother's death have an impact on whether I should take the lump sum?
Health, health, health.
And so, that really, you should really look at that.
Absolutely. So if your family lives into its 90s, you might be able to make a pension work. If your family lives into its early 60s and you're 65, you better take that lump sum or at least run the calculations to figure out what that lump sum is so that you know what kind of money you got working
with. I tend to be kind of lazy about this, and I think, well, what do most people do?
Most people take the easy way out. They ignore the letters, and then all of a sudden they get that one letter, like Jody did, from the Central States, and then all of a sudden her life is – it's not over, but the retirement that she wanted – is completely
or dependent on or worked. I mean, you count. That's a lot of
mental. Imagine telling a Teamster, hey, you were going to get $3,000 a month. Now you're going to get about $1,000.
Right.
I'm not sure I'm man enough to be able to have that conversation with thousands of Teamsters and keep doing that with a straight face and knowing that, hey, these people were relying on money. All of a sudden, it's not there.
Okay, so you get the letter. And what do you do? Do you start cutting expenses? Do you start trying to save up?
So we do a couple of different things. In any retirement plan, you got to look at income and expenses. And if there's a huge gap, you got to figure out where that money's coming from. You may have to push back retirement. You may have to take a part-time job. You may have to think about how you're going to manage debt. You're probably going to have to get your investments changed in some way. So if you're doing this on your own, there is a lot of stuff in front of you that you could theoretically blow up, and you don't want to do that. So I would get with your advisor, find one if you don't have one, but these are things that absolutely have to be addressed.
Andy Smith, thanks for making the long trip up to the studio.
It's
I appreciate
perfect.
That. You'll come back?
Absolutely.